The Return of the King, Disc 11.
Then Treebeard said farewell to each of them in turn, and he bowed three times slowly and with great reverence to Celeborn and Galadriel.
It is long, long since we met by stock or by stone. Ah, Vanema, Vanema leon nostari, he said. It is said that we should meet only thus at the ending. For the world is changing. I feel it in the water. I feel it in the earth, and I smell it in the air. I do not think we shall meet again.
And Celeborn said,
I do not know, eldest.
But Galadriel said, Not in Middle-earth, nor until the lands that lie under the wave are lifted up again. Then in the willow meads of Tasarnan, we may meet in the spring. Farewell. Last of all, Merry and Pippin said good-bye to the old Ent, and he grew gayer as he looked at them.
Well, my merry folk, he said, will you drink another draught with me before you go?
Indeed we will, they said, and he took them aside into the shade of one of the trees, and there they saw that a great stone jar had been set. And Treebeard filled three bowls, and they drank. And they saw his strange eyes looking at them over the rim of his bowl.
Take care, he said, for you have already grown since I saw you last.
And they laughed and drained their bowls.
Well, goodbye, he said, and don't forget that if you hear any news of the Entwives in your land, you will send word to me.
Then he waved his great hands to all the company and went off into the trees. The travellers now rode with more speed, and they made their way towards the Gap of Rohan. And Aragorn took leave of them at last, close to that very place where Pippin had looked into the stone of Orthonk. The hobbits were grieved at this parting, for Aragorn had never failed them, and he had been their guide through many perils. "I wish we could have a stone that we could see all our friends in," said Pippin, "and that we could speak to them from far away."
"Only one now remains that you could use," answered Aragorn, "for you would not wish to see what the stone of Minas Tirith would show you. But the Palantir of Orthonk the king will keep, to see what is passing in his realm and what his servants are doing. For do not forget, Peregrine Took, that you are a knight of Gondor, and I do not release you from your service. You are going now on leave, but I may recall you. And remember, dear friends of the Shire, that my realm lies also in the north, and I shall come there one day."
Then Aragorn took leave of Celeborn and Galadriel, and the lady said to him, "Elfstone, through darkness you have come to your hope, and have now all your desire. Use well the days." But Celeborn said,
"Kinsman, farewell. May your doom be other than mine, and your treasure remain with you to the end."
With that they parted, and it was then the time of sunset. And when, after a while, they turned and looked back, they saw the King of the West sitting upon his horse with his knights about him, and the falling sun shone upon them, and made all their harness to gleam like red gold, and the white mantle of Aragorn was turned to a flame. Then Aragorn took the green stone and held it up, and there came a green fire from his hand. Soon the dwindling company, following the Isen, turned west and rolled through the gap into the wastelands beyond, and then they turned northwards and passed over the borders of Dunland. The Dunlendings fled and hid themselves, for they were afraid of Elvish folk, though few indeed ever came to their country. But the travellers did not heed them, for they were still a great company, and were well provided with all that they needed, and they went on their way at their leisure, setting up their tents when they would. On the sixth day since their parting from the king, they journeyed through a wood, climbing down from the hills at the feet of the misty mountains that now marched on their right hand. As they came out again into the open country at sundown, they overtook an old man leaning on a staff, and he was clothed in rags of grey or dirty white, and at his heels went another beggar, slouching and whining.
"Well, Saruman," said Gandalf, "where are you going?"
"What is that to you?" he answered. "Will you still order my goings, and are you not content with my ruin?"
"You know the answers," said Gandalf. "No and no. But in any case, the time of my labours now draws to an end. The king has taken on the burden. If you had waited at Orthonk, you would have seen him, and he would have shown you wisdom and mercy."
"Then all the more reason to have left sooner," said Saruman, "for I desire neither of him. Indeed, if you wish for an answer to your first question, I am seeking a way out of his realm."
"Then once more you are going the wrong way," said Gandalf, "and I see no hope in your journey. But will you scorn our help, for we offered it to you?" "To me?" said Saruman. "Nay, pray do not smile at me. I prefer your frowns, and as for the lady here, I don't trust her. She always hated me, and schemed for your part. I don't doubt that she has brought you this way to have the pleasure of gloating over my poverty. Had I been warned of your pursuit, I would have denied you the pleasure."
"Saruman," said Galadriel, "we have other errands, and other cares that seem to us more urgent than hunting for you. Say rather that you are overtaken by good fortune, for now you have a last chance."
"If it be truly the last, I'm glad," said Saruman, "for I shall be spared the trouble of refusing it again. All my hopes are ruined, but I would not share yours, if you have any."
For a moment his eyes kindled.
"Go," he said. "I did not spend long study on these matters for naught. You've doomed yourselves, and you know it, and it will afford me some comfort as I wander to think that you pulled down your own house when you destroyed mine. And now, what ship will bear you back across so wide a sea?" he mocked. "It will be a grey ship, and full of ghosts." He laughed, but his voice was cracked and hideous.
"Get up, you idiot!" he shouted to the other beggar, who had sat down on the ground, and he struck him with his staff. "Turn about! If these fine folk are going our way, then we will take another. Get on, or I'll give you no crust for your supper."
The beggar turned and slouched past, whimpering.
"Poor old dreamer, poor old dreamer, always beaten and cursed. How I hate him. I wish I could leave him."
"Then leave him," said Gandalf.
But Wormtongue only shot a glance of his bleared eyes full of terror at Gandalf, and then shuffled quickly past behind Saruman. As the wretched pair passed by the company, they came to the hobbits, and Saruman stopped and stared at them, but they looked at him with pity.
"So you've come to gloat too, have you, my urchins?" he said. "You don't care what a beggar lacks, do you? For you've all you want. Food and fine clothes and the best weed for your pipes. Oh, yes, I know. I know what it comes from. You wouldn't give a pipeful to a beggar, would you?"
"I would if I had any," said Frodo. "You can have what I've got left," said Merry, "if you'll wait a moment." He got down and searched in the back of his saddle. Then he handed to Saruman a leather pouch. "Take what there is," he said. "You're welcome to it. It came from the flotsam of Isengard."
"Mine, mine, yes, and dearly bought," cried Saruman, clutching at the pouch. "This is only a repayment in token, for you took more, I'll be bound. Still, a beggar must be grateful, if a thief returns him even a morsel of his own. Well, it will serve you right when you come home, if you find things less good in the south farthing than you would like. Long may your land be short of leaf."
"Thank you," said Merry. "In that case, I'll have my pouch back, which is not yours, and has journeyed far with me. Wrap the weed in a rag of your own."
"One thief deserves another," said Saruman, and turned his back on Merry and kicked Wormtongue and went away towards the wood.
"Well, I like that," said Pippin. "Thief indeed! What of our claim for waylaying, wounding, and orc dragging us through Rohan?"
"Ah," said Sam.
"And bought," he said.
How, I wonder? And I didn't like the sound of what he said about the South Farthing. It's time we got back.
I'm sure it is, said Frodo. But we can't go any quicker if we're to see Bilbo. I'm going to Rivendell first, whatever happens.
Yes, I think you'd better do that, said Gandalf. But alas for Saruman, I fear nothing more can be made of him. He's withered altogether. All the same, I'm not sure that Treebeard is right. I fancy he could do some mischief still in a small, mean way.
Next day they went on into the northern Dunland, where no men now dwelt, though it was a green and pleasant country. September came in with golden days and silver nights, and they rode at ease until they reached the Swanfleet River, and found the old ford, east of the falls where it went down suddenly into the lowlands. Far to the west in a haze lay the meres and eyots through which it wound its way to the grey flood. There countless swans housed in a land of reeds. So they passed into a region, and at last a fair morning dawned, shimmering above gleaming mists. And looking from their camp on a low hill, the travellers saw, away in the east, the sun catching three peaks that thrust up into the sky through floating clouds. Carathras, Celebdil, and Fanuithol. They were near to the gates of Moria. Here now for 7 days they tarried, for the time was at hand for another parting, which they were loath to make. Soon Celeborn and Galadriel and their folk would turn eastward, and so pass by the Redhorn Gate, and down the Dimrill Stair to the Silverlode, and to their own country. They had journeyed thus far by the westways, for they had much to speak of with Elrond and with Gandalf, and here they lingered still in converse with their friends. Often, long after the hobbits were wrapped in sleep, they would sit together under the stars, recalling the ages that were gone and all their joys and labours in the world, or holding counsel concerning the days to come. If any wanderer had chanced to pass, little would he have seen or heard, and it would have seemed to him only that he saw grey figures carved in stone, memorials of forgotten things now lost in unpeopled lands. For they didn't move or speak with mouth, looking from mind to mind, and only their shining eyes stirred and kindled as their thoughts went to and fro. But at length all was said, and they parted again for a while, until it was time for the three rings to pass away. Quickly fading into the stones and the shadows, the grey-cloaked people of Lorien rode towards the mountains, and those who were going to Rivendell sat on the hill and watched, until there came out of the gathering mist a flash, and then they saw no more. Frodo knew that Galadriel had held aloft her ring in token of farewell. Sam turned away and sighed. "I wish I was going back to Lorien." At last, one evening, they came over the high moors, suddenly, as to travellers it always seemed, to the brink of the deep valley of Rivendell, and saw, far below, the lamp shining in Elrond's house. And they went down, and crossed the bridge, and came to the doors, and all the house was filled with light and song for joy at Elrond's homecoming. First of all, before they had eaten or washed or even shed their cloaks, the hobbits went in search of Bilbo. They found him all alone in his little room. It was littered with papers and pens and pencils, but Bilbo was sitting in a chair before a small bright fire. He looked very old, but peaceful and sleepy. He opened his eyes and looked up as they came in.
"Hello, hello," he said. "So you've come back. And tomorrow's my birthday, too. How clever of you. Do you know, I shall be 129, and in 1 year more, if I'm spared, I shall equal the old Took. I should like to beat him, but we shall see."
After the celebration of Bilbo's birthday, the four hobbits stayed in Rivendell for some days, and they sat much with their old friend, who spent most of his time now in his room, except at meals. For these he was still very punctual as a rule, and he seldom failed to wake up in time for them. Sitting round the fire, they told him in turn
all that they could remember of their journeys and adventures. At first he pretended to take some notes, but he often fell asleep, and when he woke he would say,
"How splendid! How wonderful! But where were we?"
Then they went on with the story from the point where he had begun to nod. The only part that seemed really to rouse him and hold his attention was the account of the crowning and marriage of Aragorn.
"I was invited to the wedding, of course," he said, "and I've waited for it long enough, but somehow, when it came to it, I found I had so much to do here, and packing is such a bother."
When nearly a fortnight had passed, Frodo looked out of his window and saw that there had been a frost in the night, and the cobwebs were like white nets. Then suddenly he knew that he must go and say good-bye to Bilbo. The weather was still calm and fair after one of the most lovely summers that people could remember. But October had come, and it must break soon and begin to rain and blow again. And there was still a very long way to go. Yet it was not really the thought of the weather that stirred him. He had a feeling that it was time he went back to the Shire. Sam shared it. Only the night before he had said,
"Well, Mr. Frodo, we've been far and seen a deal, and yet I don't think we've found a better place than this. There's something of everything here, if you understand me. The Shire and the Golden Wood and Gondor and King's Houses and Inns and Meadows and Mountains all mixed. And yet, somehow, I feel we ought to be going soon. I'm worried about my gaffer, to tell you the truth."
"Yes, something of everything, Sam, except the sea," Frodo had answered, and he'd repeated it now to himself. "Except the sea." That day Frodo spoke to Elrond, and it was agreed that they should leave the next morning. To their delight, Gandalf said,
"I think I shall come too, at least as far as Bree. I want to see Butterbur."
In the evening they went to say good-bye to Bilbo.
"Well, if you must go, you must," he said. "I am sorry. I shall miss you. It's nice just to know that you're about the place, but I'm getting very sleepy."
Then he gave Frodo his mithril coat and sting, forgetting that he had already done so. And he gave him also three books of lore that he had made at various times, written in his spidery hand, and labelled on their red backs, "Translations from the Elvish by B.B. To Sam he gave a little bag of gold.
"Almost the last drop of the Smaug vintage," he said. "May come in useful if you think of getting married, Sam."
Sam blushed.
"I've nothing much to give to you young fellows," he said to Merry and Pippin, "except good advice." And when he had given them a fair sample of this, he added a last item in Shire fashion. "Don't let your heads get too big for your hats. But if you don't finish growing up soon, you're going to find hats and clothes expensive."
"But if you want to beat the old Took," said Pippin, "I don't see why we shouldn't try and beat the Bull Roarer."
Bilbo laughed, and he produced out of a pocket two beautiful pipes with pearl mouthpieces and bound with fine wrought silver.
"Think of me when you smoke them," he said. "The elves made them for me, but I don't smoke now."
And then suddenly he nodded and went to sleep for a little, and when he woke up again he said,
"Now where were we? Yes, of course, giving presents. Which reminds me, what's become of my ring, Frodo, that you took away?"
"I've lost it, Bilbo, dear," said Frodo. "I got rid of it, you know."
"What a pity," said Bilbo. "I should have liked to see it again. But no, how silly of me. That's what you went for, wasn't it? To get rid of it. But it's all so confusing, for such a lot of other things seem to have got mixed up with it. Aragorn's affairs, and the White Council, and Gondor, and the Horsemen, and Southrons, and Oliphants. Did you really see one, Sam? And caves, and towers, and golden trees, and goodness knows what besides. I evidently came back by much too straight a road from my trip. I think Gandalf might have shown me round a bit.
But then the auction would have been over before I got back, and I should have had even more trouble than I did. Anyway, it's too late now, and really I think it's much more comfortable to sit here and hear about it all. The fire's very cosy here, and the food's very good, and there are elves when you want them. What more could one want?
The road goes ever on, out from the door where it began. Now far ahead the road has gone, let others follow it who can. Let them a journey new begin, but I at last with weary feet will turn towards the lighted inn, my evening rest and sleep to meet.
And as Bilbo murmured the last words, his head dropped on his chest, and he slept soundly. The evening deepened in the room, and the firelight burned brighter, and they looked at Bilbo as he slept and saw that his face was smiling. For some time they sat in silence, and then Sam, looking round at the room and the shadows flickering on the walls, said softly, "I don't think, Mr. Frodo, that he's done much writing while we've been away. He won't ever write our story now." At that Bilbo opened an eye, almost as if he had heard. Then he roused himself.
"You see, I'm getting so sleepy," he said, "and when I have time to write, I only really like writing poetry. I wonder, Frodo, my dear fellow, if you would very much mind tidying things up a bit before you go. Collect all my notes and papers, and my diary, too, and take them with you, if you will. You see, I haven't much time for the selection and the arrangement and all that. Get Sam to help, and when you've knocked things into shape, come back and I'll run over it. I won't be too critical."
"Of course I'll do it," said Frodo, "and of course I'll come back soon. It won't be dangerous any more. There is a real king now, and he'll soon put the roads in order."
"Thank you, my dear fellow," said Bilbo. "That really is a very great relief to my mind." And with that he fell fast asleep again.
The next day Gandalf and the hobbits took leave of Bilbo in his room, for it was cold out of doors, and then they said farewell to Elrond and all his household. As Frodo stood upon the threshold, Elrond wished him a fair journey and blessed him, and he said, "I think, Frodo, that maybe you will not need to come back unless you come very soon. For about this time of the year, when the leaves are gold before they fall, look for Bilbo in the woods of the Shire. I shall be with him." These words no one else heard, and Frodo kept them to himself.
Chapter 7 Homeward Bound. At last the hobbits had their faces turned towards home. They were eager now to see the Shire again, but at first they rode only slowly, for Frodo had been ill at ease. When they came to the ford of Bruinen, he had halted, and seemed loath to ride into the stream. And they noted that for a while his eyes appeared not to see them or things about him. All that day he was silent. It was the 6th of October.
"Are you in pain, Frodo?"
said Gandalf quietly, as he rode by Frodo's side.
"Well, yes, I am," said Frodo. "It's my shoulder. The wound aches, and the memory of darkness is heavy on me. It was a year ago today."
"Alas, there are some wounds that cannot be wholly cured," said Gandalf.
"I fear it may be so with mine," said Frodo. "There is no real going back. Though I may come to the Shire, it will not seem the same, for I shall not be the same. I'm wounded with knife, sting, and tooth, and a long burden. Where shall I find rest?"
Gandalf did not answer. By the end of the next day, the pain and unease had passed, and Frodo was merry again, as merry as if he did not remember the blackness of the day before. After that the journey went well, and the days went quickly by, for they rode at leisure,
and often they lingered in the fair woodlands, where the leaves were red and yellow in the autumn sun. At length they came to Weathertop, and it was then drawing towards evening, and the shadow of the hill lay dark on the road. Then Frodo begged them to hasten, and he would not look towards the hill, but rode through its shadow with head bowed and cloak drawn close about him. That night the weather changed, and a wind came from the west laden with rain, and it blew loud and chill, and the yellow leaves whirled like birds in the air. When they came to the Chetwood, already the boughs were almost bare, and a great curtain of rain veiled Bree Hill from their sight. So it was that near the end of a wild and wet evening, in the last days of October, the five travellers rode up the climbing road and came to the south gate of Bree. It was locked fast, and the rain blew in their faces, and in the darkening sky low clouds went hurrying by, and their hearts sank a little, for they had expected more welcome. When they had called many times, at last the gatekeeper came out, and they saw that he carried a great cudgel. He looked at them with fear and suspicion, but when he saw that Gandalf was there, and that his companions were hobbits, in spite of their strange gear, then he brightened and wished them welcome.
"Come in," he said, unlocking the gate. "We won't stay for news out here in the cold and the wet, a ruffianly evening. But old Barley will no doubt give you a welcome at the pony, and there you will hear all there is to hear."
"And there you'll hear later all that we say, and more," laughed Gandalf. "How's Harry?"
The gatekeeper scowled.
"Gone," he said. "But you'd best ask Barleyman. Good evening." "Good evening to you," they said, and passed through.
And then they noticed that behind the hedge at the roadside a long, low hut had been built, and a number of men had come out and were staring at them over the fence. When they came to Bill Ferney's house, they saw that the hedge there was tattered and unkempt, and the windows were all boarded up.
"Do you think you killed him with that apple, Sam?" said Pippin.
"I'm not so hopeful, Mr. Pippin," said Sam. "But I'd like to know what became of that poor pony. He's been on my mind many a time, and the wolves howling and all."
At last they came to the prancing pony, and that at least looked outwardly unchanged. And there were lights behind the red curtains in the lower windows. They rang the bell, and Nob came to the door, and opened it a crack and peeped through, and when he saw them standing under the lamp he gave a cry of surprise.
"Mr. Butterbur! Master!" he shouted. "They've come back!"
"Oh, have they? I'll learn them!"
came Butterbur's voice, and out he came with a rush, and he had a club in his hand. But when he saw who they were, he stopped short, and the black scowl on his face changed to wonder and delight.
"Nob, you woolly-pated ninny," he cried. "Can't you give old friends their names? You shouldn't go scaring me like that, with times as they are. Well, well, and where have you come from? I never expected to see any of you folk again, and that's a fact. Going off into the wild with that Strider and all those black men about? But I'm right glad to see you, and none more than Gandalf. Come in, come in. The same rooms as before. They're free. Indeed, most rooms are empty these days, as I'll not hide from you, for you'll find it out soon enough. And I'll see what can be done about supper, as soon as may be. But I'm short-handed at present. Hey, Nob, you slow coach, tell Bob. Ah, but there I'm forgetting. Bob's gone. Goes home to his folk at nightfall now. Well, take the guest's ponies to the stables, Nob, and you'll be taking your horse to his stable yourself, Gandalf, I don't doubt. A fine beast, as I said when I first set eyes on him. Well, come in, make yourselves at home."
Mr. Butterbur had at any rate not changed his manner of talking, and still seemed to live in his old breathless bustle. And yet there was hardly anybody about, and all was quiet. From the common room there came a low murmur of no more than two or three voices. And seen closer in the light of two candles that he lit and carried before them, the landlord's face looked rather wrinkled and careworn. He led them down the passage to the parlour that they had used on that strange night more than a year ago, and they followed him, a little disquieted, for it seemed plain to them that old Barleyman was putting a brave face on some trouble. Things were not what they had been. But they said nothing and waited. As they expected, Mr. Butterbur came to the parlour after supper to see if all had been to their liking. As indeed it had. No change for the worse had yet come upon the beer or the victuals at the Pony, at any rate.
"Now I won't make so bold as to suggest you should come to the common room tonight," said Butterbur. "You'll be tired, and there isn't many folk there this evening anyway. But if you could spare me half an hour before you go to your beds, I would dearly like to have some talk with you, quiet-like, by ourselves."
"That is just what we should like too," said Gandalf. "We are not tired. We've been taking things easy. We were wet, cold, and hungry, but all that you've cured. Come, sit down, and if you have any pipeweed, we'll bless you."
"Well, if you'd called for anything else, I'd have been happier," said Butterbur. "That's just the thing that we're short of, seeing how we've only got what we grow ourselves, and that's not enough. There's none to be had from the Shire these days, but I'll do what I can."
When he came back, he brought them enough to last them for a day or two, a wad of uncut leaf. "South Lynch," he said, "and the best we have, but not the match of South Farthing, as I've always said, though I'm all for Bree in most matters, begging your pardon." They put him in a large chair by the wood fire, and Gandalf sat on the other side of the hearth, and the hobbits in low chairs between them, and then they talked for many times half an hour, and exchanged all such views as Mr. Butterbur wished to hear or give. Most of the things which they had to tell were a mere wonder and bewilderment to their host, and far beyond his vision, and they brought forth few comments other than, "You don't say," often repeated in defiance of the evidence of Mr. Butterbur's own ears. "You don't say, Mr. Baggins, or is it Mr. Underhill? I'm getting so mixed up. You don't say, Master Gandalf? Well, I never. Who'd have thought it in our times?" But he did say much on his own account. Things were far from well, he would say. Business was not even fair. It was downright bad. "No one comes nigh Bree now from outside," he said. "And the inside folks, they stay at home mostly and keep their doors barred. It all comes of those newcomers and gangrels that began coming up the Greenway last year, as you may remember. But more came later. Some were just poor bodies, running away from trouble, but most were bad men, full of thievery and mischief. And there was trouble right here in Bree, bad trouble. Why, we had a real set too, and there were some folk killed dead, if you'll believe me."
"I will indeed," said Gandalf. "How many?"
3 and 2, said Butterbur, referring to the big folk and the little. "There was poor Matt Heathertoes, and Rowley Appledore, and little Tom Pickthorn from over the hill, and Willie Banks from up away, and one of the Underhills from Staddle, all good fellows, and they're missed. And Harry Goatleaf, that used to be on the West Gate, and that Bill Fernie, they came in on the stranger side, and they've gone off with them, and it's my belief they let them in. On the night of the fight, I mean. And that was after we showed them the gates and pushed them out. Before the year's end, that was, and the fight was early in the new year, after the heavy snow we had. And now they've gone for robbers and live outside, hiding in the woods beyond Archet, and out in the wilds north away. It's like a bit of the bad old times tales tell of, I say. It isn't safe on the road, and nobody goes far, and folk lock up early. We have to keep watchers all round the fence, and put a lot of men on the gates at nights. Well, no one troubled us," said Pippin, "and we came along slowly and kept no watch. We thought we'd left all trouble behind us."
"Ah, that you haven't, master, more's the pity," said Butterbur. "But it's no wonder they left you alone. They wouldn't go for armed folk, with swords and helmets and shield and all. Make them think twice, that would. And I must say it put me aback a bit when I saw you."
Then the hobbits suddenly realized that people had looked at them with amazement, not out of surprise at their return so much as in wonder at their gear. They themselves had become so used to warfare and to riding in well-arrayed companies that they had quite forgotten that the bright mail peeping from under their cloaks, and the helms of Gondor and the Mark,
and the fair devices on their shields would seem outlandish in their own country. And Gandalf, too, was now riding on his tall grey horse, all clad in white with a great mantle of blue and silver over all, and the long sword glamdring at his side. Gandalf laughed.
"Well, well," he said, "if they are afraid of just five of us, then we've met worse enemies on our travels. But at any rate, they will give you peace at night while we stay."
"How long will that be?" said Butterbur.
"I'll not deny we should be glad to have you about for a bit. You see, we're not used to such troubles, and the rangers have all gone away, folk tell me. I don't think we've rightly understood till now what they did for us, for there's been worse than robbers about. Wolves were howling round the fences last winter, and there's dark shapes in the woods, dreadful things that it makes the blood run cold to think of. It's been very disturbing, if you understand me."
"I expect it has," said Gandalf. "Nearly all lands have been disturbed these days, very disturbed. But cheer up, Barleyman. You've been on the edge of very great troubles, and I'm only glad to hear that you have not been deeper in. But better times are coming. Maybe better than any you remember. The rangers have returned. We came back with them. And there is a king again, Barleyman. He will soon be turning his mind this way. Then the greenway will be opened again, and his messengers will come north, and there will be comings and goings, and the evil things will be driven out of the wastelands. Indeed, the waste in time will be waste no longer, and there will be people and fields where once there was wilderness." Mr. Butterbur shook his head. "If there's a few decent, respectable folk on the roads, that won't do no harm," he said. "But we don't want no more rabble and ruffians. And we don't want no outsiders at Bree, nor near Bree at all. We want to be let alone. I don't want a whole crowd of strangers camping here and settling there and tearing up the wild country." "You will be let alone, Barleyman," said Gandalf. "There is room enough for realms between Isen and Greyflood, or along the shorelands south of Brandywine, without anyone living within many days' ride of Bree. And many folk used to dwell away north, 100 miles or more from here, at the far end of the Greenway, on the North Downs, or by Lake Evendim."
"Up away by Dead Men's Dyke?" said Butterbur, looking even more dubious. "That's haunted land, they say. None but a robber would go there."
"The rangers go there," said Gandalf. "Dead Men's Dyke, you say. So it has been called for long years. But its right name, Barleyman, is Fornost Arryn, Norbury of the Kings. And the king will come there again one day, and then you'll have some fair folk riding through."
"Well, that sounds more hopeful, I'll allow," said Butterbur. "And it will be good for business, no doubt, so long as he lets Bree alone."
"He will," said Gandalf. "He knows it and loves it."
"Does he now?" said Butterbur, looking puzzled. "Though I'm sure I don't know why he should, sitting in his big chair up in his great castle, 100 miles away, and drinking wine out of a golden cup, I shouldn't wonder. What's the pony to him, or mugs of beer? Not but what my beer's good, Gandalf. It's been uncommon good, since you came in the autumn of last year and put a good word on it, and that's been a comfort in trouble, I will say."
"Ah," said Sam, "but he says your beer is always good."
"He says?"
"Of course he does. He's Strider, the chief of the rangers. Haven't you got that into your head yet?"
It went in at last, and Butterbur's face was a study in wonder. The eyes in his broad face grew round, and his mouth opened wide, and he gasped.
"Strider!" he exclaimed when he got back his breath. "Him with a crown and all in a golden cup? Well, what are we coming to?"
"Better times. For Bree, at any rate," said Gandalf.
"I hope so, I'm sure," said Butterbur. "Well, this has been the nicest chat I've had in a month of Mondays, and I'll not deny that I'll sleep easier tonight and with a lighter heart. You've given me a powerful lot to think over, but I'll put that off until tomorrow. I'm for bed, and I've no doubt you'll be glad of your beds too. Hey, Nob," he called, going to the door. "Nob, you slow coach."
"Now," he said to himself, slapping his forehead, "now what does that remind me of?
"Not another letter you've forgotten, I hope, Mr. Butterbur," said Mary.
"No, no, Mr. Brandybuck, don't go reminding me of that. But there, you've broken my thought. Now, where was I? Nub, stables. Ah, that was it.
I've something that belongs to you.
If you recollect Bill Fernie and the horse thieving, his pony as you bought, well, it's here. Come back all of itself, it did. But where it had been to, you know better than me. It was as shaggy as an old dog and as lean as a clothes rail, but it was alive. Nob's looking after it.
What? My Bill? Cried Sam.
Well, I was born lucky, whatever my gaffer may say. There's another wish come true. Where is he?
Sam would not go to bed until he had visited Bill in his stable. The travellers stayed in Bree all the next day, and Mr. Butterbur could not complain of his business next evening at any rate. Curiosity overcame all fears, and his house was crowded. For a while, out of politeness, the hobbits visited the common room in the evening and answered a good many questions. Bree memories being retentive, Frodo was asked many times if he had written his book. "Not yet," he answered. "I'm going home now to put my notes in order." He promised to deal with the amazing events at Bree, and so give a bit of interest to a book that appeared likely to treat mostly of the remote and less important affairs away south. Then one of the younger folk called for a song. But at that a hush fell, and he was frowned down, and the call was not repeated. Evidently there was no wish for any uncanny events in the common room again. No trouble by day, not any sound by night, disturbed the peace of Bree while the travellers remained there, but the next morning they got up early, for as the weather was still rainy, they wished to reach the Shire before night, and it was a long ride. The Bree folk were all out to see them off, and were in merrier mood than they had been for a year. And those who had not seen the strangers in all their gear before gaped with wonder at them. At Gandalf with his white beard, and the light that seemed to gleam from him, as if his blue mantle was only a cloud over sunshine, and at the four hobbits like riders upon errantry out of almost forgotten tales. Even those who had laughed at all the talk about the king began to think there might be some truth in it.
"Well, good luck on your road, and good luck to your homecoming," said Mr. Butterbur. "I should have warned you before that all's not well in the Shire, neither, if what we hear is true. Funny goings on, they say, but one thing drives out another, and I was full of my own troubles. But if I may be so bold, you've come back changed from your travels, and you look now like folk as can deal with troubles out of hand. I don't doubt you'll soon set all to rights. Good luck to you. And the oftener you come back, the better I'll be pleased."
They wished him farewell and rode away, and passed through the west gate and on towards the Shire. Bill the pony was with them, and as before, he had a good deal of baggage, but he trotted along beside Sam and seemed well content. "I wonder what old Barleyman was hinting at," said Frodo.
"I can guess some of it," said Sam gloomily. "What I saw in the mirror, trees cut down and all, and my old gaffer turned out of the row, I ought to have hurried back quicker."
"And something's wrong with the South Farthing, evidently," said Mary. "There's a general shortage of pipeweed."
"Whatever it is," said Pippin, "Lotho will be at the bottom of it. You can be sure of that."
"Deep in, but not at the bottom," said Gandalf. "You've forgotten Saruman. He began to take an interest in the Shire before Mordor did."
"Well, we've got you with us," said Merry, "so things will soon be cleared up."
"I'm with you at present," said Gandalf, "but soon I shall not be. I'm not coming to the Shire. You must settle its affairs yourselves. That is what you've been trained for. Do you not yet understand? My time's over. It's no longer my task to set things to rights, nor to help folk to do so. And as for you, my dear friends, you will need no help. You're grown up now, grown indeed very high, among the great you are, and I have no longer any fear at all for any of you. But if you would know, I am turning aside soon. I'm going to have a long talk with Bombadil, such a talk as I've not had in all my time. He's a moss-gatherer, and I've been a stone doomed to rolling. But my rolling days are ending, and now we shall have much to say to one another.
In a little while they came to the point on the east road where they had taken leave of Bombadil, and they hoped and half expected to see him standing there to greet them as they went by. But there was no sign of him, and there was a grey mist on the Barrow Downs southwards, and a deep veil over the old forest far away. They halted, and Frodo looked south wistfully.
"I should dearly like to see the old fellow again," he said. "I wonder how he's getting on."
"As well as ever, you may be sure," said Gandalf, "quite untroubled, and, I should guess, not much interested in anything that we've done or seen, unless perhaps in our visits to the Ents. There may be a time later for you to go and see him. But if I were you, I should press on now for home, or you will not come to the Brandywine Bridge before the gates are locked."
"But there aren't any gates," said Merry. "Not on the road. You know that quite well. There's the Buckland Gate, of course, but they'll let me through that at any time."
"There weren't any gates, you mean," said Gandalf. "I think you'll find some now. And you might have more trouble even at the Buckland Gate than you think. But you'll manage all right. Goodbye, dear friends. Not for the last time. Not yet. Goodbye." He turned Shadowfax off the road, and the great horse leapt the green dyke that here ran beside it, and then at a cry from Gandalf he was gone, racing towards the Barrow Downs like a wind from the north.
"Well, here we are, just the four of us that started out together," said Merry. "We've left all the rest behind, one after another. It seems almost like a dream that has slowly faded."
"Not to me," said Frodo. "To me it feels more like falling asleep again."
Chapter 8. The Scouring of the Shire. It was after nightfall when, wet and tired, the travellers came at last to the Brandywine, and they found the way barred. At either end of the bridge there was a great spiked gate, and on the further side of the river they could see that some new houses had been built, two-storied, with narrow, straight-sided windows, bare and dimly lit, all very gloomy and unshire-like. They hammered on the outer gate and called, but there was at first no answer, and then, to their surprise, someone blew a horn, and the lights in the windows went out. A voice shouted in the dark,
"Who's that? Be off! You can't come in. Can't you read the notice? No admittance between sundown and sunrise."
"Of course we can't read the notice in the dark," Sam shouted back. "And if hobbits of the Shire are to be kept out in the wet on a night like this, I'll tear down your notice when I find it."
At that a window slammed, and a crowd of hobbits with lanterns poured out of the house on the left. They opened the further gate, and some came over the bridge. When they saw the travellers, they seemed frightened.
"Come along," said Merry, recognising one of the hobbits. "If you don't know me, Hob Hayward, you ought to. I'm Merry Brandybuck, and I should like to know what all this is about, and what a Bucklander like you is doing here. You used to be on the Haygate."
"Bless me, it's Master Merry, to be sure, and all dressed up for fighting," said old Hob. "Why, they said you were dead. Lost in the old forest, by all accounts. I'm pleased to see you alive, after all."
"Then stop gaping at me through the bars and open the gate," said Merry.
"I'm sorry, Master Merry, but we have orders."
"Whose orders?"
"The chief's up at Bag End."
"Chief? Chief? Do you mean Mr. Lotho?" said Frodo.
"I suppose so, Mr. Baggins, but we have to say just the chief nowadays."
"Do you indeed?" said Frodo.
"Well, I'm glad he's dropped the Baggins at any rate. But it's evidently high time that the family dealt with him and put him in his place."
A hush fell on the hobbits beyond the gate.
"It won't do no good talking that way," said one. "He'll get to hear of it, and if you make so much noise, you'll wake the chief's big man."
"We shall wake him up in a way that will surprise him," said Mary. "If you mean that your precious chief has been hiring ruffians out of the wild, then we've not come back too soon."
He sprang from his pony, and seeing the notice in the light of the lanterns, he tore it down and threw it over the gate. The hobbits backed away and made no move to open it.
"Come on, Pippin," said Merry. "Two is enough."
Merry and Pippin climbed the gate, and the hobbits fled. Another horn sounded. Out of the bigger house on the right, a large, heavy figure appeared against the light in the doorway.
"What's all this?" he snarled as he came forward. "Gate breaking? You clear out, or I'll break your filthy little necks."
Then he stopped, for he had caught the gleam of swords.
"Bill Ferney," said Merry, "if you don't open that gate in 10 seconds, you'll regret it. I shall set steel to you if you don't obey, and when you've opened the gates, you'll go through them and never return. You're a ruffian and a highway robber."
Bill Ferney flinched and shuffled to the gate and unlocked it.
"Give me the key," said Merry, but the ruffian flung it at his head and then darted out into the darkness.
As he passed the ponies, one of them let fly with his heels and just caught him as he ran. He went off with a yelp into the night and was never heard of again.
"Neat work, Bill," said Sam, meaning the pony.
"So much for your big man," said Merry. "We'll see the chief later. In the meantime, we want a lodging for the night, and as you seem to have pulled down the bridge in and built this dismal place instead, you'll have to put us up."
"I am sorry, Mr. Merry," said Hob, "but it isn't allowed."
"What isn't allowed?"
"Taking in folk offhand like, and eating extra food and all that," said Hob.
"What's the matter with the place?" said Merry. "Has it been a bad year or what? I thought it had been a fine summer and harvest."
"Well, no, the year's been good enough," said Hob. "We grows a lot of food, but we don't rightly know what becomes of it. It's all these gatherers and sharers, I reckon, going round counting and measuring and taking off to storage. They do more gathering than sharing, and we never see most of the stuff again."
"Oh, come," said Pippin, yawning. "This is all too tiresome for me tonight. We've got food in our bags. Just give us a room to lie down in. It'll be better than many places I've seen."
The hobbits at the gate still seemed ill at ease. Evidently some rule or other was being broken. But there was no gainsaying 4 such masterful travellers, all armed, and 2 of them uncommonly large and strong-looking. Frodo ordered the gates to be locked again. There was some sense, at any rate, in keeping a guard, while ruffians were still about. Then the 4 companions went into the hobbit guardhouse and made themselves as comfortable as they could. It was a bare and ugly place, with a mean little grate that would not allow a good fire. In the upper rooms were little rows of hard beds, and on every wall there was a notice and a list of rules. Pippin tore them down. There was no beer and very little food, but with what the travellers brought and shared out, they all made a fair meal. And Pippin broke rule 4 by putting most of the next day's allowance of wood on the fire.
"Well now, what about a smoke, while you tell us what's been happening in the Shire?" he said.
"There isn't no pipeweed now," said Hob, "at least only for the chief's men. All the stock seem to have gone. We do hear that wagon loads of it went away down the old road out of the South Farthing, over Sarn Ford way. That would be the end of last year, after you left. But it had been going away quietly before that, in a small way, that Lotho—"
"Now you shut up, Hob Hayward," cried several of the others. "You know talk of that sort isn't allowed.
The chief will hear of it, and we'll all be in trouble."
"He wouldn't hear naught if some of you here weren't sneaks," rejoined Hob hotly.
"All right, all right," said Sam. "That's quite enough. I don't want to hear no more. No welcome, no beer, no smoke, and a lot of rules and orc talk instead. I hoped to have a rest, but I can see there's work and trouble ahead. Let's sleep and forget it till morning."
The new chief evidently had means of getting news.
It was a good 40 miles from the bridge to Bag End, but someone made the journey in a hurry, so Frodo and his friend soon discovered. They had not made any definite plans, but had vaguely thought of going down to Crick Hollow together first, and resting there a bit. But now, seeing what things were like, they decided to go straight to Hobbiton. So the next day they set out along the road and jogged along steadily. The wind had dropped, but the sky was grey. The land looked rather sad and forlorn, but it was after all the 1st of November and the fag end of autumn. Still, there seemed an unusual amount of burning going on, and smoke rose from many points round about. A great cloud of it was going up far away in the direction of Woody End. As evening fell, they were drawing near to Frogmorton, a village right on the road, about 22 miles from the bridge. There they meant to stay the night. The Floating Log at Frogmorton was a good inn. But as they came to the east end of the village, they met a barrier with a large board saying, "No Road," and behind it stood a large band of sheriffs, with staves in their hands and feathers in their caps, looking both important and rather scared. "What's all this?" said Frodo, feeling inclined to laugh.
"This is what it is, Mr. Baggins," said the leader of the sheriffs, a two-feather hobbit. "You're arrested for gate-breaking, and tearing up rolls, and assaulting gatekeepers, and trespassing, and sleeping in shire buildings without leave, and bribing guards with food."
"And what else?" said Frodo.
"That'll do to go on with," said the sheriff leader.
"I can add some more if you like it," said Sam. "Calling your chief names, wishing to punch his pimply face, and thinking you sheriffs look a lot of tomfools."
"There now, mister, that'll do. It's the chief's orders that you're to come along quiet. We're going to take you to Bywater and hand you over to the chief's men, and when he deals with your case, you can have your say. But if you don't want to stay in the lockholes any longer than you need, I should cut the say short if I was you."
To the discomfiture of the sheriffs, Frodo and his companions all roared with laughter.
"Don't be absurd," said Frodo. "I'm going where I please and in my own time. I happen to be going to Bag End on business, and if you insist on going too, well, that's your affair."
"Very well, Mr. Baggins," said the leader, pushing the barrier aside. "But don't forget I've arrested you."
"I won't," said Frodo. "Never. But I may forgive you. Now, I'm not going any further today, so if you'll kindly escort me to the Floating Log, I'll be obliged."
"I can't do that, Mr. Baggins. The inn's closed. There's a sheriff house at the far end of the village. I'll take you there."
"All right," said Frodo. "Go on and we'll follow."
Sam had been looking the sheriffs up and down, and had spotted one that he knew.
"Hey, come here, Robin Smallborough," he called. "I want a word with you."
With a sheepish glance at his leader, who looked wrathful but did not dare to interfere, Sheriff Smallborough fell back and walked beside Sam, who got down off his pony.
"Look here, Cock Robin," said Sam. "You're hobbit and bred, and ought to have more sense, coming away laying Mr. Frodo and all. And what's all this about the inn being closed?"
"They're all closed," said Robin. "The chief doesn't hold with beer. Leastways, that is how it started. But now I reckon it's his men that has it all. And he doesn't hold with folk moving about. So if they will or they must, then they has to go to the sheriff house and explain their business."
"You ought to be ashamed of yourself having anything to do with such nonsense," said Sam. "You used to like the inside of an inn better than the outside yourself. You were always popping in, on duty or off."
"And so I would be still, Sam, if I could. But don't be hard on me. What can I do? You know how I went for a sheriff 7 years ago, before any of this began. Give me a chance of walking round the country and seeing folk and hearing the news and knowing where the good beer was. But now it's different."
"But you can give it up. Stop sheriffing, if it has stopped being a respectable job," said Sam.
"We're not allowed to," said Robin.
"If I hear 'not allowed' much oftener," said Sam,
I'm going to get angry.
Can't see as I'd be sorry to see it, said Robin, lowering his voice. If we all got angry together, something might be done. But it's these men, Sam, the chief's men. He sends them round everywhere, and if any of us small folks stand up for our rights, they drag him off to the lockholes. They took old Flour Dumpling, old Will Whitfoot the mayor, first, and they've taken a lot more. Lately it's been getting worse. Often they beat him now.
Then why do you do their work for them? Said Sam angrily. Who sent you to Frogmorton?
No one did. We stay here in the big sheriff house. We're the first East Farthing troop now. There's hundreds of sheriffs all told, and they want more with all these new rules. Most of them are in it against their will, but not all. Even in the shire, there is some as like minding other folks' business and talking big. And there's worse than that. There's a few as do spy work for the chief and his men.
Ah, so that's how you had news of us, is it?
That's right. We aren't allowed to send by it now, but they use the old quick post service and keep special runners at different points. One came from Whitfurrow's last night with a secret message, and another took it on from here. And a message came back this afternoon saying you was to be arrested and taken by Bywater, not direct to the lockholes. The chief wants to see you at once, evidently.
He won't be so eager when Mr. Frodo's finished with him, said Sam. The sheriff house at Frogmorton was as bad as the bridge house. It had only one story, but it had the same narrow windows, and it was built of ugly pale bricks, badly laid. Inside it was damp and cheerless, and supper was served on a long, bare table that had not been scrubbed for weeks. The food deserved no better setting. The travellers were glad to leave the place. It was about 18 miles to Bywater, and they set off at 10 o'clock in the morning. They would have started earlier, only the delay so plainly annoyed the sheriff leader. The west wind had shifted northward, and it was turning colder, but the rain was gone. It was rather a comic cavalcade that left the village, though the few folk that came out to stare at the get-up of the travellers did not seem quite sure whether laughing was allowed. A dozen sheriffs had been told off as escort to the prisoners, but Merry made them march in front, while Frodo and his friends rode behind. Merry, Pippin and Sam sat at their ease laughing and talking and singing, while the sheriff stumped along trying to look stern and important. Frodo, however, was silent and looked rather sad and thoughtful. The last person they passed was a sturdy old gaffer clipping a hedge.
"Hello, hello," he jeered. "Now who's arrested who?"
Two of the sheriffs immediately left the party and went towards him.
"Leader," said Merry, "order your fellows back to their places at once if you don't want me to deal with them."
The two hobbits, at a sharp word from the leader, came back sulkily.
"Now get on," said Merry.
And after that the travellers saw to it that their ponies' pace was quick enough to push the sheriffs along as fast as they could. The sun came out, and in spite of the chilly wind they were soon puffing and sweating. At the 3-farthing stone they gave it up. They'd done nearly 14 miles with only one rest at noon. It was now 3 o'clock. They were hungry and very footsore, and they could not stand the pace.
"Well, come along in your own time," said Merry. "We're going on."
"Good-bye, Cock Robin," said Sam. "I'll wait for you outside the Green Dragon, if you haven't forgotten where that is. Don't dawdle on the way."
"You're breaking a rest, that's what you're doing," said the leader ruefully, "and I can't be answerable."
"We shall break a good many things yet, and not ask you to answer," said Pippin. "Good luck to you."
The trap trotted, and as the sun began to sink towards the white downs far away on the western horizon, they came to Bywater by its wide pool. And they really had their first painful shock. This was Frodo and Sam's own country, and they found out now that they cared about it more than any other place in the world. Many of the houses that they had known were missing. Some seemed to have been burned down. The pleasant row of old hobbit holes in the bank on the north side of the pool were deserted, and their little gardens that used to run down bright to the water's edge were rank with weeds. Worse, there was a whole line of the ugly new houses all along poolside, where the Hobbiton Road ran close to the bank. An avenue of trees had stood there. They were all gone. And looking with dismay up the road towards Bag End, they saw a tall chimney of brick in the distance. It was pouring out black smoke into the evening air. Sam was beside himself.
"I'm going right on, Mr. Frodo," he cried. "I'm going to see what's up. I want to find my gaffer."
"We ought to find out first what we're in for, Sam," said Mary. "I guess that the chief will have a gang of ruffians handy. We'd better find someone who'll tell us how things are around there." But in the village of Bywater, all the houses and holes were shut, and no one greeted them. They wondered at this, but they soon discovered the reason of it. When they reached the Green Dragon, the last house on the Hobbiton side, now lifeless and with broken windows, were disturbed half a dozen large, ill-favoured men lounging against the inn wall. They were squint-eyed and sallow-faced.
"Like that friend of Bill Fernie's at Bree," said Sam.
"Like many that I saw at Isengard," muttered Mary. The ruffians had clubs in their hands and horns by their belts, but they had no other weapons, as far as could be seen. As the travellers rode up, they left the wall and walked into the road, blocking the way.
"Where do you think you're going?" said one, the largest and most evil-looking of the crew. "There's no road for you any further. And where are those precious sheriffs?"
"Coming along nicely," said Mary.
"A little footsore, perhaps. We promised to wait for them here."
"Gone. What did I say?" said the ruffian to his mates. "I told Sharkey it was no good trusting those little fools. Some of our chaps ought to have been sent."
"And what difference would that have made, pray?" said Mary. "We're not used to footpads in this country, but we know how to deal with them."
"Footpads, eh?" said the man. "So that's your tone, is it? Change it, or we'll change it for you. You little folk are getting too uppish. Don't you trust too much in the boss's kind heart. Sharkey's come now, and he'll do what Sharkey says."
"And what may that be?" said Frodo quietly.
"This country wants waking up and setting to rights," said the ruffian, "and Sharkey's going to do it, and make it hard if you drive him to it. You need a bigger boss, and you'll get one before the year is out, if there's any more trouble. Then you'll learn a thing or two, you little rat folk."
"Indeed, I'm glad to hear of your plans," said Frodo. "I'm on my way to call on Mr. Lotho, and he may be interested to hear of them too." The ruffian laughed.
"Lotho? He knows all right. Don't you worry. He'll do what Sharkey says, because if a boss gives trouble, we can change him. See? And if little folk try to push in where they're not wanted, we can put them out of mischief. See?"
"Yes, I see," said Frodo. "For one thing, I see that you're behind the times and the news here. Much has happened since you left the south. Your day is over, and all other ruffians. The Dark Tower has fallen, and there's a king in Gondor. And Isengard has been destroyed, and your precious master is a beggar in the wilderness. I passed him on the road. The king's messengers will ride up the greenway now, not bullies from Isengard." The man stared at him and smiled.
"Beggar in the wilderness?" he mocked. "Oh, is he indeed? Swagger it, my little cock-a-hoop. But that won't stop us living in this fat little country where you've lazed long enough, and—" he snapped his fingers in Frodo's face. "King's messengers? That for them. When I see one, I'll take notice, perhaps."
This was too much for Pippin. His thoughts went back to the field of Cormallen. And here was a squint-eyed rascal calling the ring-bearer Little Cock-a-Hoop. He cast back his cloak, flashed out his sword, and the silver and sable of Gondor gleamed on him as he rode forward.
"I am a messenger of the king," he said. "You're speaking to the king's friend, and one of the most renowned in all the lands of the West. You're a ruffian and a fool. Down on your knees in the road and ask pardon, or I'll set this troll's bane in you."
The sword glinted in the westering sun. Merry and Sam drew their swords also, and rode up to support Pippin. but Frodo did not move. The ruffians gave back. Scaring Breeland peasants and bullying bewildered hobbits had been their work. Fearless hobbits with bright swords and grim faces were a great surprise. And there was a note in the voices of these newcomers that they had not heard before. It chilled them with fear.
"Go," said Merry. "If you trouble this village again, you will regret it."
The three hobbits came on, and then the ruffians turned and fled, running away up the Hobbiton road, but they blew their horns as they ran.
"Well, we've come back none too soon," said Merry.
"Not a day too soon, perhaps too late at any rate to save Lotho," said Frodo. "Miserable fool, but I'm sorry for him."
"Save Lotho? Whatever do you mean?" said Pippin. "Destroy him, I should say."
"I don't think you quite understand things, Pippin," said Frodo.
"Lotho never meant things to come to this pass. He's been a wicked fool, but he's caught now. The ruffians are on top, gathering, robbing and bullying, and running or ruining things as they like, in his name, and not in his name even for much longer. He's a prisoner in Bag End now, I expect, and very frightened. We ought to try and rescue him."
"Well, I am staggered," said Pippin. "Of all the ends to our journey, this is the very last I should have thought of. To have to fight half-orcs and ruffians in the Shire itself, to rescue Lotho Pimple."
"Fight," said Frodo.
"Well, I suppose it may come to that. But remember, there's to be no slaying of hobbits, not even if they have gone over to the other side. Really gone over, I mean. Not just obeying ruffians' orders because they're frightened. No hobbit has ever killed another on purpose in the Shire, and it is not to begin now. And nobody is to be killed at all if it can be helped. Keep your tempers and hold your hands to the last possible moment."
"But if there are many of these ruffians," said Merry, "it will certainly mean fighting. You won't rescue Lotho or the Shire just by being shocked and sad, my dear Frodo."
"No," said Pippin.
"It won't be so easy scaring them a second time. They were taken by surprise. You heard the horn blowing? Evidently there are other ruffians near at hand. They'll be much bolder when there's more of them together. We ought to think of taking cover somewhere for the night. After all, we're only four, even if we are armed."
"I've an idea," said Sam. "Let's go to old Tom Cotton's down South Lane. He always was a stout fellow, and he has a lot of lads that were all friends of mine."
"No," said Merry. "It's no good getting under cover. That is just what people have been doing, and just what these ruffians like. They will simply come down on us in force, corner us, and then drive us out or burn us in. No, we've got to do something at once."
"Do what?" said Pippin.
"Raise the Shire," said Merry. "Now, wake all our people. They hate all this, you can see. All of them except perhaps one or two rascals and a few fools that want to be important, but don't at all understand what is really going on. But Shire folk have been so comfortable so long they don't know what to do. They just want a match, though, and they'll go up in fire. The chief's men must know that. They'll try to stamp on us and put us out quick. We've only got a very short time. Sam, you can make a dash for Cotton's farm if you like. He's the chief person round here, and the sturdiest. Come on. I'm going to blow the horn of Rohan, and give them all some music they've never heard before."
This ends Disc 11.